Good morning, everybody. This is Jeff J. Brown, China Rising Radio, Sinoland, on the beaches of D-Day in Normandy. And I only have to go 1 hour back to the east to one of the most ancient and magnificent countries that I've ever visited, and that's Syria. And today we have on the show today, Stephen Sahwini. How are you doing, Stephen?
I'm doing okay.
You know, we should probably do this more often. We did a reciprocal, a couple of reciprocal shows a couple of years ago, and I was shocked. I checked, and like 26,000, you know, people, you know, accessed those two shows. So there's obviously an interest in your work and what's going on in the Middle East. So I reached out to get Stephen's little newsletter, and I look at his website, and he. I said, hey, why don't we do a show? And he said, send me questions. And I said, well, I've got a better idea. Tell the fans out there the five most important things that are either not being reported or being completely distorted by the West big lie propaganda machine. He said, that's a great idea. So, Stephen, thank you for being on the show, and tell us what is number one that we need, that the fans out there need to know about and probably don't understand or don't know.
Okay. First of all, the situation in North Syria is very tension between the Syrian army and the Russians and the Kurdish militia from one side. On the other side, it's the Turkish. Both sides are sending reinforcements and sending terrorists sending weapons, cannons, because the military operation there, it might start any minute, because the problem is President of Turkey, Erdogan, is not backing down on him wanting to occupy 30 kilometers of the North Syria under the name he wants to protect his national security. The Turkish and the Iranians have met with the Iranians and the Russians have met with the Turkish, and President Putin by himself, he has met with President Erdogan in Turkey in trying to find a political solution with Syria between Ankara and Damascus, at the same time to have him preventing Turkey from doing this military operation. But until now, it doesn't look like President Erdogan, he is backing down. And a big part of this problem is the Kurdish militia. For years of the war, they trusted the Americans and they worked with the Americans, and they refused to put their hands with the Syrian government. In the end, we all know that the Americans, the American foreign policy, they're not going to get in a war with Turkey over some Kurdish militia and a few Kurdish. So they did not help them, and they were in the end, the Turkish kept bombing the Kurdish. Ankara was kept bombing the Turkish, the Kurdish. In the end, just a few months ago, they started opening political canals and negotiations with the Syrian government in Damascus, and they were asking for their help. But the same Kurdish militia, they put their hands in the hand of the Americans, and they were stealing the Syrian oil, stealing the Syrian gas, being shipped from Syria abroad. They've been benefiting from that Syrian oil, but the majority of Syria has no electricity, has no gas, has no oil. The prices are way high. And at the same time, the American sanctions are making the Syrian people suffer more, because not always a ship can come in and give us gas or oil. So that's why the economic situation is very hard in Syria, and that is because of, as I said, the sanctions, and the prices have went sky high, and that is the economic situation. Another military and security issue, and that was in the south of Syria. For about several months now, they've been sleeping cells in south of Syria in the city of Daraa, where the war started actually from. And it was supposed to that they did the agreement and they put their weapons down and they made the agreement with the Syrian government. But for the last several months, they were sleeping in cells, killing officers, killing soldiers, killing judges, school teachers. But in the end, the Syrian government kept giving chances for negotiation. They did not want to do a military operation. They wanted to finish it. They didn't want any bloodshed. But in the end, it increased, and it was in a level, unstoppable level. And that's why yesterday they started operation and a military operation, and they had succeeded of killing the leader of ISIS in south of Syria, their prince or whatever they call him, their khalifa or prince, in the south of Syria, Abu Salem al-Iraqi, in a military operation, and they eliminated him. Politically, the only, as we all know, the only solution is a political solution, not a military. But the West and the United States does not want a political solution until now. The Turkish and the Iranians and the Russians are trying their best to pressure Erdogan on sitting on the table and forcing the radical terrorist groups who are supported by him, like Hayat Tahrir al-Sham, al-Nusra, and other terrorist groups, to sit on the table and the Syrian coalition to sit on the table with Damascus and solve the situation. But until now, there is no hope for a political solution because they are not accepting, and they are going by what America, because in the end, if America wants a political solution, then it will happen. These groups, they're only bloodthirsty murderers. That's about all I have about Syria. There's another topic. Also, it's going on the news, and a lot of the news, it's been misled and propaganda, and that is about the war that happened between the Palestinian resistance and the Israeli occupation in Palestine, and the tension that's been happening in Palestine for now. It has always been there's tension, but it has increased, especially after that the Israeli occupation forces killed the journalist Shireen Abu Akel in a bullet in her head, killed in cold blood. Since then, the Israeli forces have been doing murders in the West Bank, Jenin, Nablus, Ramallah. That's all areas in the West Bank. Also, the settlers going into the Al-Aqsa Mosque and unrespecting the what's happening, the mosque, and in the end, the Israelis just a few days ago they assassinated a big leader for the Islamic Jihad, and that is a resistance groups in Gaza. They assassinated him, and that's what caused the war, and there was big losses for in both sides, of course. The Israelis are using the newest weapons and everything. But on the other side, and where the remark is that the Palestinian resistance launched over 1,000 missiles on the settlements, it showed that the Israelis, they are not ready for a war. And this, we are talking about the Islamic Jihad. We're not talking about Hamas. And that is what I wanted to say is about the Palestinian issue and the Palestinian situation is in this last war, the Israeli occupation tried and they were working on separating the resistance groups. In Gaza and Palestine, there's several. There is Hamas, there is Islamic Jihad, there is Fatah, there is several. And when there's a war, they all work together and they're united. Like one body. But the Israelis this time, they kept saying, we are targeting the Islamic Jihad. We are not targeting Hamas. Why did they say that? And why they want to separate them? First of all, they want to separate them to make them weak. And number two is because Hamas and their military wing, Kata'ab al-Qassam, they are the biggest and they are the strongest. And they are in control of Gaza. But even though the Islamic Jihad, they are not the same power as Al-Qassam and Hamas. They did a big victory because the Israelis couldn't stop the missiles, didn't achieve any of their goals. And in the end, the Israelis were the one asking the Egyptians and the Jordanians for a ceasefire, not the Palestinians. and the conditions of the Palestinians was accepted by the Israelis. In this case, it will show you that the Israelis did a big mistake by doing this war. They caused a lot of damage in their own settlements, houses, factories, and buildings and other. The flights in Ben Gurion was canceled and the planes couldn't land because of the missiles being launched on Ben Gurion. And that is only hold responsibility is their leadership. And I think they did this just for a political victory for Yair Lapid for his election coming up. And I think he burnt his papers, his cards, as they say in English. He burnt his cards because he failed big time in this war. And it showed that how the Israeli, the inside of Israel, how weak it is, the settlements, the government, and he does not have popularity in his back, and how the army and their army is so shattered, as they say. Because if a small group like Islamic Jihad did this, how can the world imagine if Israel does a mistake and do a war with the Lebanese resistance, Hezbollah, and we are talking 100 times more powerful, mm-hmm. 10,000 times more sophisticated weapons, sophisticated missiles, much better fighters. So we are talking about, and at the same time, and with all of this situation, and the world is going, as they say, the whole planet Earth is on the doors of a World War III between America mm-hmm. and Russia and America and Beijing. The Israelis, they want to do a war, and they're threatening the Lebanese and Lebanese resistance at this time. And we all, and everyone knows the power of the Lebanese resistance. When the Israelis, and here we'll flip into the Lebanese file, because they're connected, about the oil and the gas fields in the sea. The Israelis are trying to steal parts of the Lebanese side. That, of course, we all, everyone knows the Lebanese government is shattered. There's a million people in charge of it. Each political party belongs to someone. They have nothing to protect themselves. So who's protecting that oil and protecting Lebanon from an invasion?
Hezbollah.
And if it wasn't for them, we'll see the Israelis in downtown Beirut today, in a few hours, if it wasn't for them. So they are. Hezbollah sent a message to the Americans and to the Israelis. That's our land. We're not gonna, if the Lebanese government gives just doesn't negotiate seriously with you, we are here and we're not gonna allow you to steal our land and our oil and our gas from the sea. That's for our children, our families, and our for our future, to fix up our damaged and destroyed economy. So and in the speech of Hassan Nasrallah, he sent a big message to the Israelis: don't do this mistake. No one wants a war, but if you force us into a war, we are ready for it, and you will see who is going to be who will win. And the Israelis, they know that when that person and that leader, when that he talks, they believe him, and that is from Israeli media. When they did a survey several years ago, that the Israeli people, they believe Hassan Nasrallah more than they believe their own leaders. Because when he does a promise, he does it. And that's according to their media. So that's about Lebanon and their economical situation that has collapsed. Their money is collapsed. I remember when I was in Lebanon, every 1,500 Lebanese was $1. Today, every 30,000 Lebanese is $1. Mm-hmm. And you can imagine how the money collapsed completely. The poverty in Lebanon is on the highest level ever. And at the same time, you'll see political parties inside of Lebanon who are pro-Saudi Arabia and pro-America. They don't care. They don't want a solution. And they're just putting gasoline on the fire. And this... where we're worried about Syria is that any tension and any chaos in Lebanon, it will affect us. We already have our own problems. So if a civil war, God forbid, happens in Lebanon, is going to affect us in the end. And it happened in the past, and we got affected, and Syria was damaged, because what happens in Syria, it affects Lebanon. And what happens in Lebanon affects Syria. It's we're connected with each other. And that is the situation in Lebanon, Syria, and Lebanon, Syria, and Palestine. Also, there is big tension happening in Iraq. And in the political life, and all this goes back to the occupation in 2003 and the war on Iraq, when they destroyed Iraq completely. They destroyed it economically, ethically, and even and militarily. So, and politically. So today, Iraq, each political party and each leader belongs to a country. Like, you will find Shiites belong to Saudi and America. You will find other Shiites, they belong to Iran. Other, the Kurds, they belong to the Israelis and the Americans. But, some other Sunnis, they belong to either the resistance, like in Iran and Syria. Another Sunnis, they belong to Saudi Arabia and Muslim Brotherhood. And each part, they're working for the country that they belong to. They are not working for their own country. And even though that Iraq is one of the richest country on planet Earth with oil, but today the poverty in Iraq is the highest, and that is because of these politicians and these corrupt, they're corrupted politicians, and them stealing from the Iraqi people, stealing from the oil. Like, today it is impossible, and it's shocking when we are talking about Iraq, one of the big five countries of producing oil in the world. They, the Iraqi people have no electricity. Like Syria, we don't have that much oil. And the oil we have, it's being stolen. But Iraq, the oil is in the hands of the Iraqi government. And they are the big, one of the top five big country of producing oil. And they don't have electricity. That will show you the percentage of corruption in Iraq and in Baghdad. We are seeing today the politician Muqtada Sadr, the Shiite leader Muqtada Sadr, he asked his people to go down in the streets. He took over the parliament by the people. He asked his people to take over the parliament, take over the streets, and he's asking for dissolving for the parliament and a new election. So Iraq also is in chaos. The Turkish also are bombing the Kurdish in North Iraq, north of Erbil on the border with Turkey. And they have big, and there's big tension. Also, Turkey is causing chaos there. So you can see the whole region is on fire. And if you go back in each country of these countries, who is behind this this chaos? Who's behind this tension? Who's behind of the suffering of the Middle Eastern people? Iraq, the American foreign policy caused this war. In Syria, the American foreign policy sent these terrorists and funded these radical Islamic terrorists in Syria. In Lebanon, they are the American foreign policy and the American ambassador in Beirut. She's in charge of all of the politicians and the chaos happening in Lebanon. In occupied Palestine, no one can say anything to the Israelis because they are supported from the UN and in this and Security Council by the Americans. And so they can kill people, they can use any kind of weapons they want. No one can tell them, because also there is always a veto from the United Kingdom and from Washington in the Security Council. So no one will punish the Israelis. They can get out with anything they do. So we'll see, you can see there, the number one cause of the tension and the chaos and the suffering is the Americans.
Yeah. I want to ask you, why does Syria have its own missiles outside of Russia, who is helping them in your country? And if Syria does have its own missiles, why doesn't it start not hitting the Americans in the where they're stealing. I read 66,000 barrels of oil a day are being stolen by the United States and shipped to Iraq. Why doesn't Syria start hitting them? Because the only thing that the Americans listen to is when soldiers start coming back home in body bags. And so why doesn't Syria do that?
The problem is Syria is the size of LA. We're 30 million people, 10 years of war. Our allies, let's face it, our allies, they're not going to get into a regional and world war with the United States over Syria. So by ourselves, the Iranians, yes, they're our friends and they're our allies, but they're not going to get into a war with the Americans, and they will sacrifice their nuclear deal. In the end, they need their nuclear deal because also they have economical problems because of the sanctions. At the same time, the Russians, they're not going to get into a world war with the Americans over Syria. Syria is their ally. Syria is their friend. They supported Syria. The Russians have helped and saved Syria mm-hmm. big time by protecting them from the ISIS and the other terrorists. But when we're talking about the United States, let's face it, we're talking about one side. There's two sides now. One side of the most powerful country on planet Earth. Their military. They can eliminate us with a small atomic bomb. What they need is resistance. The people of that area and the Kurdish and the people of that area and the Arab tribes, they need to do operations against the Americans. The Syrian government, they cannot do such a thing because it's over our head. Like the Syrian government, if they do that, they will be taking all of Syria to, we'll be killing ourselves, assassination, killing ourselves.
Suicide,
that's what I meant.
And it's the same thing like in Iraq, you know, where they have these huge, you know, American bases, and Iraq has officially, you know, the parliament has officially demanded that the United States leave Iraq. Of course, America is occupying Iraq also. And they drop mortars or small missiles, and they never hit the bases. They always get close to the bases, but they never hit the bases. And I'm always going like, well, why don't you kill a few Americans in those bases? And it reminds me of 1983, you know, when the U.S. lost, I think it was like 18 or 20 people at the U.S. Embassy in Beirut. And then that was like in February of 83. And then in like whatever it was in November of 1983, you know, there was the truck bomb that killed 237 U.S. Marines in Beirut, and that, you know, changed American policy because they can't stand to have headlines about U.S. soldiers being killed. Of course, two days later, they invaded Grenada to remove that loss from the headlines. But why don't the missiles directly hit? Is it the same problem? Are they worried about a conflagration in Iraq?
No, actually, Iraq is easier. Iraq is, as I said, Iraq is in chaos. They don't have any government. Their army is not the same army as it was when Saddam. I'm not saying Saddam is an angel. No, he wasn't. But at least he had security, and he had the world respecting his country. And he had a strong military. He was a strong man. There was no sectarian fighting in Iraq. It was stable and secure and safe, just like how Syria was safe from 2010 and before. But today, as I said, Iraq is in chaos. Each political party and each part of Iraq belongs to a country. And those mm-hmm. people and those political parties, they go by what they're who is funding them, like either by the Americans, the Saudis, the Iranians, or whoever. Like if there's tension between America, if you notice the Iraqis, the Iraq news. If there's tension between Tehran and the United States and Washington, you will see the mortars on the Americans and the Americans being targeted. If there isn't, you'll see nothing happening. But in reality, who's occupied? Not Iranian land, it's the Iraqi land.
Okay.
That's why they're loyal. Unfortunately, a big part of them, their loyalty is for the country who's supporting them and funding them. It's not wrong to be loyal to your friend who's helping you. But number one, your loyalty should be for your country. If your country is being occupied, you should pick up a weapon and kill even by yourself. And that's why we see the Palestinian people by himself. He'll have a get his kitchen knife and he goes and stabs a few soldiers, a few policemen. He won't, even if it's by himself, without a group and without a resistance party or anything, it's by himself. But when, if we remember, it was Obama's term in 2008. Yes, that was happening. There was Iraqi resistance, and it was targeting the American soldiers, and a big part of them did pull out then. But then after that, several years after that, they came back in. But they did cause big losses, and there was a big number of the American soldiers being killed, and the NATO and Western. Also, they have been killed big time in the year 2007, 8, and 9. But today, as I said, each party, each political group, each politician, he belongs and his loyalty is to the country. Even if he's on the side, that serious side, like Syria and Iran and that, or if he's on American and Saudi, it's all the same. And that's the problem with Iraq.
I'll be honest with you, Stephen. This is all really demoralizing. I just like, oh my God, Western Empire. They love the chaos because there's always money to be made and weapons to be sold and human trafficking and money laundering and a lot of corruption, a lot of criminality. It's just really, really, I've been to Syria. I've been all over the Middle East and wonderful people this goes back to the times of Jesus Christ, you know, on the road to Damascus, the history, the culture, and just to see what the United States has done to this region with the help of France and with the help of the United Kingdom and NATO in general, because that they've all got their, you know, of course, France has completely debauched, you know, Lebanon, and it's basically a mafia holdout, you know, for the French mafia and the French bankers. And so my heart goes out to you and all the Palestinians and all of you in resistance and suffering because of illegal sanctions and unilateral sanctions. Iran, the only two countries that recognize the sanctions against Iran are Israel and the United States, and they just make them up and then chase people all over the world and prosecute them and kidnap them, like Meng Wanzhou, the CEO of Huawei, who was kidnapped for 3 years for supposedly lying about doing business with Iran. And it's just
talking about sanctions. You reminded me of something in Lebanon. Talking about Lebanon and sanctions, as we all know, that the Lebanese economy is collapsed completely, mm-hmm. and Lebanon completely has collapsed. So the Iranians came several times to the Lebanon, and they said, "We will build electricity reactors for you for free, and you can pay them for like after 10, 15 years." They refused. They offered to militarize their Lebanese army and make them powerful, because today the Lebanese army, they only have a few whatever the American army wants to throw away, they give it to the Lebanese army, like a few rifles and a few military cars that's about 30, 40, 50 years old. So the Iranians came and said, "We will give you and we'll arm your military." Also, they refused. came, they said the same thing about their military. They refused. The Russian came and they said to the Lebanon, we will give you wheat to eat because they have a big wheat problem in Lebanon and bread, and they might have no bread soon, like in the next few days, if the problem is not solved. Also, they refused the Russian. Why? All of this is why they refuse it. They are afraid of the anger of the United States on them, because they only care, those Lebanese politicians, they care about their chair, and they don't want to anger Ambassador Dorothy of in Beirut, so they won't be pulled out of their chair. That will show you about sanctions and the role of the United States.
Yeah.
And the corruption also. It's big time. It's the corruption and the politicians, if it's Lebanese or Iraqi, or even the Palestinian politicians like President Abu Mazen of the West Bank. He sits, like, after all of the murders that the Israeli does in Gaza, he still sits on the table. He's been sitting on the table for over 10, 15 years. What did he solve? What did he bring to the Palestinian people? Nothing. But on the other side, you see the Palestinian resistance. They force the Israeli to sit on the table, and they force them to accept. But the other guy, he doesn't care. He just wants to sit on his chair and stay in power, even if they're humiliating him and stealing his land day by day.
Yeah. Well, hopefully, you know, I've got my fingers crossed that the United States and NATO are going to exhaust themselves in Ukraine. It's clear that Russia is in no rush whatsoever to end the war in Ukraine. And it was NATO that thought that they were going to exhaust Russia and exhaust their missiles and exhaust their military and destroy their economy. But it's the tables have been turned. Now Russia doesn't run out of missiles, doesn't run out of guns, and they've only used 10% of their military. And
their economy is better than ever. The Russian ruble.
People are doing fine. McDonald's now has a new Russian name, and all the companies that left, they're doing, you know, they're all being replaced by Russian nationals.
People can live without McDonald's. Ask us Syrians. We've been living without McDonald's, and look how we are. We're doing awesome without McDonald's and KFC.
So they can go through that. Yeah, I hope that, that eventually, you know, and then this winter is going to be a long winter for, I'm here in France, and they're already talking, we're already turning off lights, and they're talking about heating tents in Germany and cold water showers, you know, in Germany, one of the richest countries in the world. And, you know, and then they're going to come in and they're going to, you know, create a COVID or a monkeypox panic and have us all, you know, hiding in our homes here, and, you know, we can't leave, you know, just another plandemic. And it's just, I hope that we are seeing the beginning of the end of 500 years of Western empire, Western colonialism, because it's just, they've killed billions and billions of people over the last 500 years. They've stolen, trillions and trillions of dollars worth of, you know, human and natural resources, and they're still doing it in Syria and Iraq and elsewhere. And of course, you know, the CIA, with opium and with opium and heroin in Afghanistan. I mean, it's just, we need a change. We need a change. And leaders like your president, al-Assad, and Putin, and Raisi, you know, the Iranian socialist, Islamic socialism, and China with Xi, yes, and Kim and DPRK. We need a new model. And I'm just a more win-win, less you know, of course, capitalism needs war and aggression to survive. And we're seeing that in spades in the Middle East. So Saudi Arabia is, you know, starting to is asking to join the Belt and Road Initiative. And so, you know, Brazil is resisting, you know, the American hegemony, and India is taking an independent course with Russia, you know, working with Russia. So this would never have happened, you know, even 10 or 20 years ago, much less 50 years ago. So I think we are reaching a tipping point, and people are starting to, you know, do business with rubles and other national currencies and the RMB, and India and Russia just signed a deal where they're going to start doing their trade in their national currencies. And so, well, let's just keep our fingers crossed. I know you, no electricity and Western horror show out, you know, around you in your country is difficult to live with, but I really admire you to report on it, Middle Eastern discourse, and I encourage everybody to go to Stephen's website and consult it, because he writes pretty much every day, every two or three days, he's got an article or two, and so keep up the good work.
Thank you very much. And what I wanted to say, I'm against anyone to suffer, especially with the electricity and the cold. And I really feel sorry for the European people, not the politicians, the European people, because we went through of no electricity. Our Syria went through of being cold when the temperature in Aleppo or in Damascus or Homs were under 9 degrees under zero and 10 degrees and 15 degrees under zero, and we had nothing to warm ourselves. And in the same time, their governments and their politicians, they were bringing sanctions, and they were sending for 10 years every radical Islamic terrorist from around the world to Syria. I really feel sorry for the European people, for their suffering, because in the end, people and the citizens, they're innocent, and they're being lied to by their media and propaganda by their media. But it is time for the European people, for the German people especially, stand up in the face of your politicians and stand up. You are much more powerful than the United States. You are much stronger, and you do not need the United States. You are Germany. You can build yourself and you can build your own economy, but choose the correct alliances in the world. As you said, the beginning of the end of the imperialism has already started. Today, America is not the only superpower. Today, there's China. And I see in the next 10 years, China is going to eliminate the imperialism with the help and the alliances with Russia, Iran, Syria, Venezuela, and other, and India.
DPRK.
DPR. When we see Saudi Arabia and Mohammed bin Salman saying no to President Biden, I'm not going to increase. And when he picks up the phone right after Biden leaves and does a big phone call with President Putin about the relationship between Saudi and Moscow, that will show you that the world's starting to wake up. America doesn't scare anyone anymore. So especially the European people, I feel sorry for them, but they should wake up.
I'm setting my alarm. I woke up a long time ago, but people are just the propaganda, the big lie propaganda machine. At for France's National Day on July 14th, you know, they flashed the colors of the Ukrainian flag on the Eiffel Tower. I mean, during, you know, China, you know, National Day, and it's just, you know, supporting Nazis, I mean, hardcore Nazis, you know, Zelensky, you know, Nazis, and, you know, it's just, I don't know what you and I do. What we do, we get up every day. We write, we report, we, you know, do podcasts, and we educate people. And if we help 10 or 20 people because of this, well, that's 10 or 20 people that are no longer ignorant fools. So let's keep up the good work. Don't let the bastards get us down.
They won't.
All right. Well, listen, thank you. I will put Stephen's website on the page. And Stephen, do you know, I get a little email from you that you send out to just a handful of people, but can people sign up for your, do you have like a newsletter on Middle Eastern discourse or not?
I don't, but I will have it soon.
Yeah, you need to do that, because I think a lot more people will go to it, because I just get your little email with five or six people, and that's how we stay in touch. But I think there would be thousands of people that would sign up if you could get MailChimp or something like that. Another thing you might want to do is think about Substack. You know, it's a great way to also build a following. So. Anyway, you do wonderful work. You're committed. You're knowledgeable. You're inspiring, and you never give up. And that's what it's going to take to bring this monstrous system to its knees. So thank you very much, Stephen. Talk to you later. I'll get this to you as soon as it's produced. Okay, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.